Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Congress is a mess. Bet you already knew that. But the problem is so serious that Congress just could collapse altogether. And that might cause just a few problems. It's fair to wonder at this point if the problem will ever be fixed. It's also fair to wonder who's responsible for it. One name that will come up in our conversation today, Newt Gingrich. Today we're joined by one of this nation's most respected political scientists, Tom Mann, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He and another top-flight scholar, Norm Ornstein, have just published a much-talked-about new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Tom Mann joins us now from the Brookings Studios in Washington, D.C., and Tom, it's a pleasure to have you. Good morning.
Steve, very happy to be with you.
And maybe this is a good time to thank you for some great interviews over the years for the Kansas City Star, Tom. Sure appreciate it.
I've always enjoyed doing them.
Well, when it comes to Congress, Tom, has it ever been this bad before?
Well, it's a mistake to imagine a golden era in our distant past in which everything worked smoothly and expeditiously and in a manner such that the public was overwhelmingly satisfied and trustful of their government. It's a mess all the time. It's a messy process.
It was set up to be that way, right?
Exactly. Our founders understood that we would have a large republic with many diverse competing, conflicting interests, and their idea was to try to bring together and in Washington or whatever the capital they imagined at the time would be representatives from these diverse constituencies who would have the incentives to basically wrestle with the problems confronting the country, listening to those with different views and different values, representing different interests, and try to forge some negotiation, bargaining, and
right.
compromise.
You know, we're doing a project at the Star these days that looks at the problems Congress is facing. In fact, we're working with your book to do this project. And I've talked to a few American historians about, you know, Congress and history and has it ever been this bad before. Boy, if you go back to the 1850s and the run-up to the Civil War, what you learn is that Congress was so divided over slavery and that issue that trying to organize itself and even to elect a new speaker in the mid-1850s, it took like 133 ballots. A couple of years later, it took 44 ballots. Congress simply broke down over the election of a new speaker. Couldn't even function on that level. So I guess maybe the answer is on some level, it has been that bad before.
Exactly. But it's a little worrisome to imagine that we might be in a position parallel to that of the 1850s. After
yes.
all, that
yes.
mess was finally only resolved with a bloody civil war. We've had other periods, the end of the 19th, turn of the 20th century, with deeply polarized parties and great difficulty in managing the nation's affairs. So let's acknowledge tough times before, but acknowledge that the great beauty of our system is not that it's divinely inspired or perfectly constructed, but that the people here understand we can fall short. They're capable of analyzing the situation and making self-corrections to keep us afloat and to keep us moving forward. So I think criticism is good as long as it's aimed towards some constructive end.
Is it possible that Congress could you know, completely collapse, Tom, just be unable to function given the inability to compromise and for the two parties to work together out there? Is that even a possibility?
It's possible. I think it's unlikely. It wouldn't collapse, but certainly the absence of action on some matters could lead to a public default, a financial crisis, another one, a loss of global confidence in the dollar, even more public unhappiness and an unwillingness to accept the legitimacy of whatever does get done. But I think our system is pretty durable in the sense of sort of coming to grips with the changes before we reach that level. But the point I would make is the electorate has got to be part of the solution to this. And in order for the electorate to be part of the solution, they've got to figure out what is going wrong. And what Norm Ornstein, my co-author, and I have concluded is that there is so much sort of misinformation, confusion, uncertainty about what the driving forces in our governing problems in Congress and in the political system more broadly, that frankly the public isn't in much of a position to do the constructive things that are needed to work off this crisis.
And what needs to correct that problem? And I gather you're sort of taking aim at the news media there. What does need to happen?
First of all, we simply have to recognize the source of the problem. Right now, we have a mismatch between highly polarized parliamentary-style political parties and a governing system predicated on separation of powers, checks and balances, in which majorities have a very difficult time prevailing in governance. If you have two parties so far apart and so determined to defeat the other and refusing to compromise, then in our governing system, you can't get anything done. It leads to willful obstruction and policy irresolution. So that's number one. The second is that the problem of the parties is not symmetric. It's not both of their fault in the same way. While neither of our two major parties is perfect and both engage in short-term strategic political actions and cheap-shotting and everything else, the fact is that in recent years, it's the Republican Party that has veered sharply off the tracks. It has become the equivalent in the Obama years as the parliamentary-like opposition party that's determined to oppose everything, to eschew any negotiations that don't simply lead to the majority and the president accepting all of their demands. There's a real dismissive of the legitimacy of the political opposition, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts and evidence. That is really the problem right now. We've got incentives in our system for the opposition party to do whatever it can, not to solve problems, but to undermine their solution in order to discredit the party in power, thereby making it easier for them to gain power. So that's the dilemma we have right now. If we had a parliamentary system the last 3.5 years of history in America would be quite quite different, even with exactly the same election outcomes.
We're visiting with Tom Mann of the Brookings Institution about his new book, co-authored with Norm Ornstein, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. It's a book that describes why Congress is such a mess these days. You know, this notion, Tom, that you just mentioned, that Republicans are more responsible here, at least looking back at recent years, I'm wondering how awkward of a conclusion that was for you and Norm to come up with, given your long tenure as very respected political scientists. And, you know, political scientists are supposed to be like journalists, you know, sort of down the middle and even Steven arbiters of what's going on in our politics. How awkward was it to come to that conclusion?
Steve, that's a great question. And the answer is exceedingly awkward. For us individually, because we had built our careers on being nonpartisan, non-ideological, of trying our best to do honest, serious, unbiased research, writing, and speaking about our political institutions and how they're functioning. You know, it's the same awkwardness that confronts first-rate reporters working for mainstream journalism. I'm not talking about the new partisan media. I'm talking about the mainstream media. It's exceedingly difficult for a reporter to point out that the emperor wears no clothes.
That's right. That's not how we operate, right, as much as we'd like to sometimes, yeah.
That – you know, your editors, your producers, fearful of charges of partisan or ideological bias, frightened of what it might do to revenues over the longer haul, sort of find safety in a kind of artificial balance. It's either, they're all bums, equally responsible. No one's better than the other. Or it's a he said, she said. So you you provide a platform. You know, it's like, well, he said the earth is round, but she said it's flat.
Right.
And you know,
right.
we can't pick sides on this. And sadly, there are things like that going on. I mean, a good example would be the success or failure of the economic stimulus, 2008, 2009 in particular. Most Republicans, including their nominee, say it's been an utter failure, probably done more harm than good. Wasteful government spending has slowed the economy further than it would have, and produced fewer jobs than it would have if without it. If you look at the evidence, the overwhelming, not unanimous, mind you, overwhelming consensus of hard-nosed economist is that it almost certainly produced many new jobs and higher growth than we otherwise would have had. If anything, there's probably been too little short-term stimulus and too great a willingness to push the longer-term problems further down the road. It's hard for all of us that aspire to get the story right, when you're confronting a situation where the parties really are different, and the reliability of what they say and what they propose to do is different,
right?
And we've, you know, we're being criticized. Certainly by some Republicans, but heartened by the hundreds of emails we've gotten from people who identify themselves as Republicans, who say their parties just gotten wacko, and they appreciate us for pointing out what's going on and hoping other voices within their party will have a chance to rise up and be heard.
Why is Congress such a mess? That's our topic today. If you want to join our conversation with your thoughts, maybe your ideas for how it should be reformed, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, you and Norm Ornstein don't hesitate to place blame really in the lap of one individual, and I'm talking about former Speaker Newt Gingrich. You say that he had a strategy, Tom, to get Republicans back into the majority after decades of Democratic control, and you write that the strategy was, I'm quoting here, to destroy the institution in order to save it. What do you mean he wanted to destroy the institution?
Recall that Democrats had a very long-term majority in the Congress, and in particular in the House of Representatives. When Newt was first elected in 1978, they had been in power already for almost a quarter of a century uninterrupted. And if you go back to 1930, it's just staggering to realize between 1930 and then 1994, Republicans were in the majority during only two Congresses or 4 years during that period.
Yeah.
So there was great frustration and with good reason.
Democrats didn't treat them very well, did they? Yeah,
that's right. And they took it as their birthright to be in the majority party and oftentimes abused that power. But, you know, Bob Michael, the traditional Republican leader, you know, figured, well, we're outnumbered, so let's see if we can have an influence over policy by working with them. Newt said to work with them is to perpetuate the present system.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't just sort of disagreeing over policy. It was really arguing that under Democrats, the whole institution had been utterly corrupted. And therefore, while he was aiming at the congressional Democrats, he put it in terms of the institution as a whole. It's not that Newt hated the Congress. Newt wanted to be leader of a Republican majority in Congress that was a strong independent branch of government. But in the course of his 16-year campaign to achieve that objective, which was eventually successful, he helped destroy the legitimacy of the institution with the public, and frankly,
because he had to tear down the Democrats and make them seem unworthy of being in the majority, right?
That's exactly right, and he also had to break the norms of respect for the opposition party, of a willingness to engage in serious negotiations with them, to imagine the possibility of compromising with someone from across the aisle. It really helped bring to the fore a new tribalistic partisan politics that that didn't begin with Newt. The seeds of that were planted back in the 60s and the reaction to the counterculture, the Voting Rights Act, the realignment in the South, the Roe versus Wade abortion decision, the anti-tax movement. Many things were happening, but Newt really brought this together in Washington, in the Congress, and help teach a generation of new members, new Republicans, to have contempt for the institution, to not stick around, to bring their families, to get to know members on the other side of the aisle, but to demonize them in order to gain and retain power.
What's wrong with the U.S. Congress? Again, that's our topic today. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Tom Mann is our guest. He's a very highly respected political scientist in Washington at the Brookings Institution. His new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. Yes, he's talking about Congress. Let's go to some phone calls. We have a bunch of them here for Tom Mann. Heather from Gardner. Heather, good morning.
Good morning. I just had a question. Does this, all this gridlock and all this partisanship, leave any room for a moderate independent movement? I wonder because, I mean, I actually, it's so bad that I actually left my church because I was surrounded by hardcore conservative Republicans constantly, and I'm a Democrat, and I won't go back. And I just see this cultural line, and I'm afraid that it's going to get to the point with these shootings and the Gabrielle Giffords thing, and that it's down to another civil war, and since the GOP has the guns.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if you – I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Heather, good question. Is there room for moderates, Tom? And I guess the answer, if you're in Kansas, the answer these days is no. They just got wiped out in Tuesday's primaries.
I saw that. It was just a stunning reaction, and you can see it. It gives you a sense of the political and financial apparatus associated with the far right movement within the Republican Party that has increasingly been embraced by or taken over the old Republican Party establishment. There's been a decline of moderates in both parties, but here's the point. Since Bill Clinton became president and worked hard to reposition the Democratic Party more toward the center, the Republican Party has moved sort of further right. They have become the radical party, mm-hmm. and the Democratic Party has become, if you will, a center-left party, but in some respects a old-fashioned conservative party. Conservative in the sense of opposing abrupt and dramatic change, looking for ways of building consensus to adjust programs to new challenges and problems, step-by-step, cautious, protective, while the Republican Party has become a radical party. So ironically, the independent movement now exists, moderate independent movement, within the Democratic Party. That's where the center of American politics is. So if you try to form a third party or independent movement, you'll find there's not much room. There are some disaffected Republicans, to be sure, but most Republicans have made their peace with the party, which is now a combination of economic libertarianism and moral traditionalism or even fundamentalism. And the sort of Democratic Party is just more diverse. Sure, there are left wing elements to the party, but the core and the leadership is problem solving and pragmatic. So
you're saying, Tom, if you want moderation, you have to go to the Democrats these days.
Right now, that is the only alternative. Eventually, what you would hope is that the Republican Party, as it exists now, would get strong signals from the public, from the electorate, to move to a less ideological, more problem-solving move, fine to be conservative, but back into the mainstream of not saying we're real Americans, but the other people aren't. That there's only one definition of how the Constitution came to be, and
right.
That's through divine inspiration. We need – our country has always survived because of its tolerance, its willingness to accept differences and live with those differences.
Let's grab one more phone call before our break here. Let's go to Matt from Baldwin City. And, Matt, you're on with Tom Mann from the Brookings Institution.
Well, this is an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I've heard a couple of key words used. The first, your guest used the term tribal, and then a caller used the term civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see going on, and may I make a suggestion, that who we're dealing with here is demographically and culturally the old Confederacy. And you look at the places where the people come from, and you kind of look at what their attitudes are toward humanity. And you're dealing with a group that is maybe seems tribal. I would place it more in the structure of like a clan, C-L-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you see a resurgence of a kind of a fascination with these kind of southern rural and frontier values. Kind of emanating up through, and it's kind of, and it's sort of appropriate that Newt Gingrich was from, you know, was involved with this. So
being from Georgia
you
is your
that.
Point, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Tom, do you want to respond to that?
Thanks, Matt. I think it's a very interesting observation, and it is significant that the, if you will, the center of gravity of the Republican Party in contemporary time has moved to the South, and in particular to the rural and outer metropolitan areas within the South. It involves really a religious fundamentalism and other sort of psychological cultural dimensions that are not unrelated to race as well. So the observation is, I think, a wise one. What I would say, and an encouraging note, is that we are changing demographically. The changes are extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the rural South is declining as a share of the population. We are becoming more non-white. There are growing numbers of Hispanics, Asians, other nationalities coming into the electorate. There is a sort of the youngest cohort is remarkably tolerant on a whole range of social issues, even while sort of, you could say, traditionally fiscally conservative,
mm-hmm.
Although the modern Republican Party isn't fiscally conservative. They're just for lower spending and lower taxes, whatever that means for deficits and debt. And you're also seeing growth in high-tech areas, young professionals,
right.
Unmarried women, although women more generally, all of whom are sort of trending away from this newly formed but with deep roots Republican Party. These are changes that have already led to Democratic success in Colorado and New Mexico, Nevada. You can see these changes occurring in Texas. It'll be some time, but frankly, the Republican Party, as they define their agenda today, cannot survive in the long run, given these demographic changes and the kind of tribal, cultural, civil war that you mention. They will be in a decidedly disadvantaged position.
And yet, Tom, the House of Representatives is controlled by Republicans. The Senate, the betting line very well could go Republican after this election. And Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are, you know, neck and neck these days for the presidency, which, you know, you begin to wonder if the Democrats are the party of middle of the roaders and therefore more independent voters. You think the advantage might be greater on the Democratic side.
You certainly would, and that's how the system is supposed to work. But remember, we are in a very difficult economic period.
Mm-hmm.
We've lived through the worst financial and economic crisis since the 1930s. The beginning of the unraveling in 2008 helped Barack Obama get elected president. But since then, it's been the Democrats in power, and therefore it's the party in power that suffers when times are really tough economically. So rather than engage in a weighing of policy alternatives or ideological positioning, the swing voters tend to vote against the party in power. And that has provided an opportunity for Republicans to make real headway. That explains much of what happened in the 2010 election. And the only reason 2012 election is so close and competitive is because of the mediocre performance of the economy. The problem from a governance and democratic accountability perspective is that you don't get a clean vote on this, because you have separate elections for the president and the Congress, and then you have midterm elections. And so you can set up incentives for a minority party to try to weaken a president's program for economic recovery and manage to stop a good part of it, and then blame him for the lack of economic recovery. And it's a pretty around the world, it's a pretty successful formula. So that's the dilemma. There's a lot of luck in politics and of timing. Timing means everything. If our economy were perking along at 3% and unemployment was down below 8%, the election would be a Democratic one, probably across the board, not a landslide. In these deeply polarized times, most voters are loyal to one party or the other, but it would be a Democratic time. I just think you don't get a good choice on party ideology and alternatives during bad economic times.
Tom, we got to go to a break. We've got Tom Mann for about 10 more minutes. Russ, Sean, and Dale, hang on. We'll get to your phone calls when we get back. Again, we're talking about why Congress is such a mess with the Brookings Institution's Tom Mann. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I just love it when Kim Noble speaks Spanish. Yeah, it's just great. If you're just joining us, so you're listening to Up to Date, and we are talking with Tom Mann of the Brookings Institution about his new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. It's about Congress and what a mess it is. Lots of folks want to speak with Tom. Let's go to some calls here at 816-235-2888. Russ from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Russ.
A question asked was, how did this happen? My take on it is that it started with the Nixon and his election manager trying to split the Democratic vote by putting Catholics against Protestants on the issue of reproductive medicine and family planning. Since then, it's kind of been a matter of one Republican trying to out-Christian the other, even to the extent that now they believe the U.S. was founded by fundamentalists instead of deists and the Unitarians. A deist, by the way, believes that God created the earth, then took a walk and left it ticking like a clock as its own animal. George Washington was one. There were many others. The overall idea that the rural South, if you don't go to my church, I don't trust you, is the primary constituency of the Republican Party does disturb me, since it used to be a Northeastern intellectual party. I don't see an end to this. The candidates have to be crazier and crazier on hot button issues that they actually believe now to get elected by an electorate that is prizing ignorance as a virtue. And I've actually heard this stated, that the less you know, the better a voter you'll be.
Yeah.
So where do you go from there? I'll take my answer via the airwaves, but not my cell phone. Thank you.
Yeah, Russ, thank you. And, is there an end to this thing, Tom? You offer some solutions in this book, and maybe it'd be a good time to tick off one or two of them.
Listen, there's no immediate solution. Russ is right about in previous times, the evangelicals really divided their support between the two parties, and that made it easier for both parties to be more tolerant of other religious beliefs and non-religious beliefs. But now they have associated themselves strongly with the Republican Party and have come to have a dominant voice in them. I think over time, there's much more diversity within the religious communities. Some of the evangelical ministers are pro-environment. They believe in climate change and want to do something about it. They're concerned about AIDS and a whole host of other such matters. And the Catholic Church is more than its conservative hierarchy. At the rank and file level, the social justice Catholic movement remains alive and well. But you're absolutely, Russ is right that as we've put ourselves into separate groups reflecting different values, we select new neighborhoods based on finding like-minded people. We listen to media outlets that reinforce our existing views, and we come to believe things that simply are not true because that's our only source of information. Obviously, that means many things. One, because of our lower turnout, especially in primary elections, we tend to give additional power to those at the extreme poll of the party. So increasing participation much more broadly would help enriching the public square, where we can actually get people with diverse views to come together and talk to one another is an important element as well. But we also need leadership from outside the political world. We need people to speak up in the business community, in civil society, and frankly, religious leaders who are more open and tolerant. We need other voices to come to the fore. Right now, it's the most strident, extreme voices that garner the attention of the media and that help push the public in the same direction.
Let's go to Dale from Kansas City, Kansas. Dale, you're on with Tom Mann. His book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. Good morning, Dale.
Thank you, and I actually believe his premise, but the reason I was calling, you were mentioning earlier, and this is dealing with the media. One of my concerns has been and continues to be that the media seems to want to do this, walk this, both sides are right or neither side is wrong. And the example you gave, the one group believes the earth is round and another group believes it's flat. I'm just trying to figure out what purpose does that in fact serve for the public?
Tom?
It serves no purpose. It's destructive. In my view, it demobilizes and disarms the public because it leads them to feel, it's just the system as a whole. There's nothing we can do about it. At most, they think if they send new representatives who are not politicians, who won't engage in that nefarious behavior in Washington like bargaining and compromising, things will be better. It's really quite destructive for the press to do this, but it serves, you know, it's a tough job. They have professional norms and they want to be fair-minded. And it's risky to point out where things are not equivalent because they'll be subject to criticisms from media watchdog groups that that will say they're just not playing it fair. But we need sort of more courage, more strength, more confidence to get to the reality and help the public understand what's going on.
Well, Tom, I want to appreciate I really appreciate you taking the time with us. Again, Tom Mann's book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. He co-wrote it with Norm Ornstein. If you're looking for solutions to what the problems that Tom is laying out here, you can find a whole bunch of them in this book. And as always, Tom, I sure appreciate you taking the time.
Steve, it's really a pleasure to be with you again. Thanks.
All the best. That's Tom Mann from the Brookings Institution.